We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome back to another episode of New Orleans.Football. Flying solo today. Mike's on vacation. He's in Orlando doing Disney Universal, that whole thing. Guess we had to give him a couple days off to recharge after a long season. And the Saints are also recharging their offensive coaching staff. We got a lot of stuff to break down. We bring in my guy, Matthew Collier from Purple Insider, to break down Clint Kubiak's tenure in Minnesota and some cap talk with Brad Spielberger and a whole lot more from today's episode presented by PJ's Coffee. And we're at our new studio right next door to Matt Bowers. If you need a new car, make sure you check him out. Best prices, best customer care, best of everything that you can find at a car dealership. All right, let's hit these ads. The New Orleans.Football Show is proudly presented by PJ's Coffee. PJ's Coffee has some of the best drinks that you can find. They have locations all over the city. They have pastries and everything else you need to get your day started. So go check them out. Are you looking for the perfect engagement ring? Look no further than Friend & Company Fine Jewelers' new engagement salon. This new area houses a wide selection of engagement rings to choose from in all cuts, sizes, and colors. Their experienced staff offer five-star customer care to help you find the perfect ring to express your love. Visit their new engagement salon today. Friend & Company Fine Jewelers, the perfect ring for the perfect moment and also for the perfect person. 7713 Maple Street between Adams and Burdett Street. 504-866-5433. Friend & Company Fine Jewelers. Check them out at friendandcompany.com. Hard Hide Punch Tool Strawberry Whiskey is an 86 proof blend of aged wheat bourbon, American light whiskey, and fresh Punch Tool strawberries. Blended in New Orleans, it is not for the thin-skinned. Look for it in your favorite stores, bars, and restaurants. New Orleans Stop Football is proud to be sponsored by Firehouse Subs. Make sure you check out their location on Veterans Boulevard. All right, let's get into the show. All right, let's get into our lead topic presented by Friend & Company Fine Jewelers, official jewelers of the New Orleans Saints. Friend & Company Fine Jewelers is excited to announce the opening of their new engagement salon. So if you're getting engaged, make sure you go and check them out. They can make your dreams come true at pretty much any price point. Go in there, talk to Ken and his team, and they'll take care of you. Tell them that we sent you. Friend & Company has a wide selection of engagement rings. And while you're there, check out their Florida Lee earring and necklace. They are specially priced for our NOF audience. All right, the lead topic today, Doug Marrone was let go from the coaching staff. The offensive line coach and quarterbacks coach, Ronald Curry, chose to leave to take a position with the Buffalo Bills. These moves mean that Clancy Barone is the last remaining staff member from the main position groups on this team underneath Clint Kubiak. He coached with Kubiak in Denver, so it's not necessarily a huge surprise that he's sticking around. But there's going to be new blood completely across the board. So, first of all, let's start off with the Marrone one. I don't think this one was necessarily a huge surprise given how the offensive line performed last season. Trevor Penning didn't quite develop as hoped, which was a bit of a disappointment. Although I do think that we need to keep in mind that Marrone did bring Cesar Ruiz back from kind of the area of ruins and got him back on track a year ago. So I don't know that the Penning problem is necessarily a symptom of Marrone's coaching. I think it might be more a symptom of Penning at this point, but we're going to see, and bringing in somebody that can help him out, maybe give him a different point of view, maybe get him going, isn't the worst thing in the world. But none of this is really about any of the coaches. Typically, when a guy comes in, he wants his people with him. And in a scheme like this, where it is so reliant on the running game, I don't think it's a terrible thing that Kubiak has his own guys that are brought up in his system, his father's system, the Shanahan system, to come along with him and make sure that the offense is working at peak capacity. And I think the main point here to look at is that the 49ers last year averaged 5.6 yards per carry on outside zone runs. The Saints averaged 3.7 yards per carry on those same plays. So that is not a very good number for a team. And when a team is so built upon that, I think a lot of it does have to do with having the right guy teaching the running game. And I don't know that that's necessarily Marone's strength. So it felt like time for him to move on. I'm sure he's going to land on his feet somewhere and be fine and get everything going the way he wants to get it going. But it wasn't going to work here. So it's going to be interesting to see where they go with this hire. There's a few guys with ties to Kubiak around the league. I'm sure he's going to tap into one of them. And then a quarterback's coach, some guys to keep an eye on, or obviously I think Kubiak's brother, who had the same role in San Francisco. Now, technically, you can't really take a guy for a lateral move unless the team lets him out of his contract. Maybe that's something that the 49ers would be willing to do, but they could simply add something like pass game coordinator to his title, and it technically would be a promotion. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on. But the Curry departure is something that, you know, I think was inevitable to a certain extent. I don't think that he left because he was upset about not getting the offensive coordinator job. I think he understood that. And I think he would have willingly stayed here as the quarterback's coach moving forward, and it wouldn't have been a problem for him. He would have kept doing that job. But they offered him the wide receiver's job, the role that he used to be in before, and that would have been kind of a demotion for him. So it's not a surprise for him to say no and take this job up in Buffalo. And I think it's probably the best move for him at this given time. Like, I couldn't have taken that job. I couldn't have stepped back in that role. It's kind of insulting at a certain point to ask somebody to do that. So he kind of had to leave. Joe Brady takes him. He's going to go up to Buffalo. He's going to coach Josh Allen. I think it's a good situation for him. He's going to get exposed to same type of offense, but from a different mind. They're going to have success there. If Allen kind of irons a couple things out, it's going to reflect well on Curry, and he might get that opportunity to become a offensive coordinator sooner than later, maybe even sooner than he would here, because that runway in Buffalo is going to be a lot longer than it is in New Orleans. And you know, I think he's going to have a lot of opportunity to kind of prove himself. But look, there's a lot on Kubiak here now. He's going to have a clean slate. He's going to fill out that staff with all of his guys. And I think for the Saints, it's a good thing too. Like, they needed the clean house. They needed to move away from that Sean Payton era. They needed to start doing things a different way, let go of the past, and kind of just keep moving on with you know, the future. And I think the future needs to be something completely different at this point. So we're going to watch Kubiak in the Super Bowl this weekend. We're going to get a look at that offense. You know, obviously Kyle Shanahan's calling it, and we've kind of been studying some of it over the last week, and we're going to keep breaking all that down moving forward. We got a story on the website right now looking at one motion. I called it like the orbit return motion because it's just so interesting, and tracked it through a season and saw all the different ways they built off of that. But I don't think that the playbook is going to be the big issue for Kubiak. Like, anyone can look at the Shanahan playbook because it's on screen every single Sunday, and you can draw them plays out. You can put them in your playbook. You can make them part of your arsenal, but you do have to be able to call them, and you got to be able to call them effectively in the right order at the right time to make them work. And I think that's the thing Kyle Shanahan kind of does better than anybody in the league. You just watch how they operate, and he seems to always call the right play at the right time to shatter a team. He creates tendencies to break them. He creates tendencies within the same game to break them. He creates tendencies throughout a whole season to break them. Like, I was watching this motion, and it took until the end of the year for them to do the handoff that I thought was going to come in week one, but they just kept building off it and doing different things and building off it and doing different things, and then they finally shattered it. So it's going to be interesting to see how Kubiak learned from that during his year in San Francisco, if it influenced his ability to call games in any type of way, and if there's any growth from what he did in Minnesota. And to kind of get a feel on that, we brought in my guy Matthew Collier to talk about the year that Kubiak was the offensive coordinator in Minnesota. So we're going to bring in Matthew now and get into that conversation. All right, joined now by my guy Matthew, covers the Vikings at Purple Insider, author of Football is a Numbers Game, incredible book. Make sure you check it out. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere you buy books. Great read. Some great excerpts, too, I saw just over the last few weeks, like detailing how coaches got their start in some of the analytics. Before we jump into Clint Kubiak and his time with Minnesota, Zach Robinson, another guy that just got hired. You had a great excerpt from your book, just about how he got started at PFF. Just tell us a little bit about that and some stuff that's in the book.
Yeah, it was so interesting. And I appreciate Zach Robinson climbing the ladder here for book promotion. It's helped me out because every time he gets advanced, I get to tweet about it. But no, I mean, Zach Robinson was an NFL quarterback who did not really make it. And he suffered an injury, kind of had like the Tommy John type of injury, and had to decide, like, am I going to try to come back from this, keep my career going, or what am I going to do? And so he started training quarterbacks and was kind of like not sure about where his career was headed. And then his friend Bobby Slowick had been working for PFF. Actually, Mike Shanahan asked PFF if they could hire Bobby Slowick after Shanahan got fired in Washington. So then there was kind of like a coach there who knew Zach Robinson. So Zach came in and kind of took the spot that Bobby had there, and he helped PFF work through coverages, quarterback grades, and shape those grades, which I think people don't understand how much PFF grades are shaped by NFL people. The offensive line grades were helped greatly by Paul Alexander, who was the Bengals offensive line coach for a really long time. And then people like Bobby Slowick and Zach Robinson. And so he studied a ton of film and looked at the numbers and everything else to do these grades. And then when he went to try to get into coaching and talk to Sean McVay, he found that watching all of that film and doing all of that grading, he understood a lot of the things that Sean McVay had been looking at on tape, and they really connected quite well through doing that. And he ends up getting an assistant quarterback coach job there and ends up advancing, as I guess anyone who works for Sean McVay does. But it was a very cool story to tell. And he talked about how in their building, they're using PFF and PFF's ultimate system, which is in every single building in the NFL. They're using it all the time. And I think that where it helps a lot of these people in coaching now is to understand how to utilize the numbers when it comes to not only just game planning and things like that and finding weaknesses in your opponent, but even just to watch the right things, to find the right film, to look for answers all the time. And I think that's what Sean McVay likes in people that he hires, which is sort of a curious mind and always looking for new answers and things like that. And I think that matched up really well with Zach Robinson. So it was very cool to tell that story.
So you covered Clint Kubiak in 2021, the year he was Minnesota's offensive coordinator. They were kind of league average in a lot of different categories, yards, points, all that stuff. Not too good, not too bad. What were some of the things that kind of stood out about him during his tenure there? And it's kind of interesting to me because people in Minnesota seem to talk about it like it was a difficult situation. So what were just kind of some of your takeaways from that year with him in that role?
Yeah, I think that anytime we're trying to evaluate an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, we really have to take into account the context and the situation that they're dealing with. So with Clint Kubiak, if you look at just where they were as a franchise when he was the offensive coordinator, Mike Zimmer was very much on the hot seat. They had signed Kirk Cousins. They had won just one playoff game the previous year. They had missed the playoffs, and Zimmer seemed to be losing control of the organization a little bit, even just in that training camp. If you remember, there was the, you know, back and forths with Kirk things that we don't want to necessarily get into on the show with vaccinations and all that, but it made for an incredibly tense atmosphere with Zimmer versus his quarterback. And also Zimmer just in general has been a historically difficult person to work with because I think that he would have a vision for what the offense was supposed to be. And maybe that vision was a little antiquated. You even go back to Norv Turner walking out in the middle of a season, John DeFilippo being fired in 2018. And even when Kevin Stefanski was the offensive coordinator, I think Zimmer had more hands in the offense than he should have, because we know how good Kevin Stefanski is at his job. And then you're following up also, Gary Kubiak was the offensive coordinator in 2020, and Gary's one of the best ever. So, you know, I think that it was a little bit of a difficult spot because he was trying to recreate Gary Kubiak and run that same exact offense and try to basically be a version of what his dad had been. And one of the problems that he faced was that Dalvin Cook was not the same in 2021 as he was in 2020. So they wanted to build everything up off the run, but yet their run attack was not the same because Dalvin was dealing with injuries throughout 2021. And that created some challenges. But what I do remember is that opening script wise, they were really, really excellent that season. And I also noticed that year that Kirk Cousins' sacks were reduced. I think that Clint Kubiak wanted to use a little more quick game than Gary, who had run a lot of play action, deep shots, classic Gary Kubiak stuff. And the results were pretty good. They lost some games early in the season in like silly fashion. They fumbled in overtime. They missed a field goal and like the wheels kind of came off a little bit. But I do think that Clint Kubiak with that experience can improve on some of the shortcomings. Probably the biggest was I remember third quarters, like third quarters were always an issue. Like if they, once they got off the opening script, they weren't quite the same. And maybe that's a feel for play calling thing that is developed over many years. But I think like schematically, we know that it worked early in games and their schemes would work. But I think it was just a matter of learning how to be a play caller. And the other thing is too, that any of us do our jobs worse under pressure, and everyone who was working under Mike Zimmer that year was really feeling the pressure.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because like my biggest thought with him is like, yeah, it's great. You have the great offense. You're exposed to Shanahan. You have the plays. But like, I think the thing that makes Kyle so special is his ability to call the right plays at the right time. And you can't just necessarily replicate that all the time. Now, I'm about to ask you a question. As someone who covers a team, like I know this is kind of a BS question and it's going to be really hard to answer because it's tough to know the impact that position coaches have on a team. Sometimes, especially if it's not extremely obvious that somebody kind of just rises through the ranks. But losing Rick Dennison that year due to him not wanting to take the vaccine, do you think that had any impact on their run game? And was there anything that you saw that was kind of like, all right, this is tangibly because Dennison isn't here?
Oh, yeah, massive thing that impacted them greatly. I mean, in 2019 and 2020, they still had weaknesses in pass blocking because I don't think you can really scheme up pass blocking. It's usually me versus you. But when it comes to the run blocking, a lot of that has to do with how it's schemed and how you teach it. And the thing about Rick Dennison is that man had been teaching that run scheme for a very, very long time, and it had worked for a very, very long time. I mean, they had mastered that outside zone thing. And, you know, I think that the Shanahan offense in general has really advanced from just that. Like they use a lot of different stuff now that's gotten more and more creative and more multiple in its looks. When you watch Christian McCaffrey, Christian McCaffrey's not out there running like Terrell Davis. So they've really shaped it to their talent. But Delvin Cook was like he was like Terrell Davis as far as how he was built and the type of outside zone runner. And when they didn't quite have the same level of detail on the offensive line, I think it really affected them. And then when your whole offense was fundamentally built off of that, and then that's not working in the same way as it did before, I think it impacted them. And it, by no means did they have a terrible offense that year. I would just call it like joggy, where it would be like our Zoom connection when I'm on hotel Wi-Fi, where like sometimes it works nice and smooth and other times it would be like, what's going on here? And a lot of times that was whether they were running the football or not. So I think Clint Kubiak leaned a little bit more on quick game. But one thing I know just foundationally with the Shanahan tree and Gary Kubiak is that they always would try to play to their players' strengths. And I know this is a little bit off of the offensive line, you know, question there, but I think that as Clint Kubiak goes to New Orleans, like he takes that with him. And I'm very curious to see what he does when he's sort of outside of the foundation of exactly the way Mike Zimmer wanted to run this thing and tries to work to the strengths of some of New Orleans' playmakers.
It's definitely something they need. There were times last year where like Mike Thomas would start off a game and have seven catches in the first quarter and then not get the ball again. And yeah, that definitely is one of the things that you see the Shanahan teams do is they kind of just, they find that vein and they tap it and they try to keep going into it. You're a student of the game. You literally wrote a book about being a student of the game. Just kind of inside football here, like the Saints had Pete Carmichael as OC, was terrible to talk to, didn't learn anything from him. What's Kubiak like just as, you know, an interview and somebody that can kind of teach you about the game a little bit?
Yes, this is funny because when Clint Kubiak got hired, I remember somebody saying to me, oh, Clint Kubiak is your OC. Great guy. You're going to love him. And then our first press conference, we were like, oh, are we talking about the same person? And I don't believe that was because of Clint Kubiak. I think that every offensive coordinator that Mike Zimmer ever had went to that podium very afraid of things that they were going to say coming back to them. And the stories that I've heard over the years of things that people said at podiums, including Kirk Cousins. I know this used to drive him crazy. He would give some sort of answer, some sort of X's and O's answer. Now, this happened Kansas City 2019. There was some big incomplete pass, and Kirk Cousins broke it down for us after the game. Here's what I saw. Here's what happened. Mike Zimmer went to the podium the next day and said, he shouldn't be telling you guys that stuff. And it was like, it was just like a normal answer that, of course, the other team would have clearly known. But it was like, that was the atmosphere and the environment that Mike Zimmer created for those people. And I think that if you were like in Indianapolis at the combine, having a beer with Clint Kubiak, and you just were chatting about this, he would probably say that he had a lot more to break down for us through those questions, but did not feel very comfortable doing it. So, you know, when Gary Kubiak was the OC, he's not intimidated by anybody. He would just answer all of our questions. But I think that Clint, being the first time he was an OC, really didn't want to step on his own feet very much, really didn't want to be called into the coach's office for anything he said at the podium. So he tried to keep it very, very bland and vanilla. But I think it really comes down to, is that the environment that you have there with Dennis Allen? Or maybe that's like who he wants to present himself as, is somebody who's not getting a lot of quotes on NewOrleans.football. So yeah, we'll see. I'm actually curious. I actually want to watch some press conferences of him to see like what, which was it. Everybody's different when it comes to that. Some guys like to teach you the game through those press conferences, and some guys like to protect all of the inside football knowledge. But I guess right now I would not bet on huge, brilliant long forms of his press conferences on your website, but we'll see. I'm interested in that.
Now, you kind of fair not cover the quarterback. That's sort of like the baseline for averageness, and you've seen how different systems affect them, how they elevate, how they maybe don't elevate. How much have you seen just Kirk Cousins be able to play better in like the right system versus the wrong system? Because I think there's probably some parallels here to Derek Carr, who kind of needs that structure around him to be lifted up a little bit. So, you know, I think probably recently O'Connell's seems like from a distance has done a great job of kind of putting quarterbacks in the right situation. Just how have you seen that effect on him over the years?
Yeah. So it's funny about Kirk Cousins, maybe I'm just in a hotel, so I'm making all of these references to the hotel, but it's kind of like trying to get the temperature right in your hotel where for some reason 68 is freezing and so 70 true. Is blazing hot. That's how it is with Kirk Cousins, where it's like, at first they try to lean into him as a shotgun quick game quarterback with John DeFilippo in 2018. That wasn't quite right. The OC got fired. 2019, they ran the ball extremely well. They ran a lot of those play actions, screens. Their screen game was amazing under Kevin Stefanski, but ultimately their offense was just okay, and it wasn't enough in the playoffs. And, you know, the same thing with both Kubiaks, where it's like they had great moments and they tried different things, building off of the run, looking for Gary was looking for deep shots. And if you look at average depth of target, they had in 2019 and 2020, they had it looked like an offense from the 90s where they were just taking shots downfield all the time and then running on first and second. And then Kubiak came in, Clint, and he was using more quick game and getting the ball into his playmakers' hands. And all of it succeeded to a point, but all of it had a ceiling because of who the quarterback is, because at some point you need that guy to break out of what is drawn up for him. And with Kevin O'Connell, it's been the same thing where it's like he played pretty well in his first year. His numbers actually went down from when Clint Kubiak was the offensive coordinator, but they really leaned into a pass first, and they don't even have any idea how to run the ball at this point, but their passing game has had a good amount of success. You see Justin Jefferson's numbers. And yet when it came to, you need to outscore the Giants in a home playoff game, they couldn't do it. Or, you know, last year they start 4-4 when their defense sputters a little bit because the offense has its limitations because the quarterback has his limitations. And I think that there is a point there probably about Derek Carr. It's a little bit of Spider-Man meme with these two guys where every offensive coordinator, every team always thinks, you know, if we just do one thing a little different, then maybe we'll get over that hump with that guy. And yet there is generally a ceiling for that. So I guess I wouldn't be surprised if there's criticism of Clint Kubiak at some point, you know, halfway through the season of he's not doing this or that or the other thing for Derek Carr, when really other teams have guys like Patrick Mahomes or Lamar Jackson or whatever, who can just, oh, the scheme didn't work on this play, let me run away. And even Brock Purdy does this for Kyle Shanahan. Brock Purdy had to make Shanahan right a couple times with scrambles in the NFC Championship to win. So a lot of times, like, it does come down to that.
So what you're saying is the mediocre quarterback always stays mediocre. There is no better days.
I'm saying that, like, there's no more frustrating type of quarterback because you know how good they are. Like, I have a lot of respect for Derek Carr and I have a lot of respect for Kirk Cousins. I mean, these are really good NFL quarterbacks, but they're just not quite to the level of the guys who are greatness at that position. And so what you end up doing is going 9-8. Like, that's what ends up happening because there's answers. Like, there's always been answers to Kirk Cousins, whether it was a quick game offense or whether it was a deep shot offense. And there's always been answers to Derek Carr as well. So what you have to rely on is hopefully you get an easy schedule. Hopefully people stay healthy around him. Hopefully your run game works. Hopefully, like, a lot of things have to go right. I think what we saw from Patrick Mahomes this year is everything can go wrong around him and end up in the Super Bowl. Whereas I think every other team is sort of in that world outside of maybe four or five teams with great quarterbacks that's in the world of everything has to go right. Now, the thing that's going for Derek Carr is when I look at that division, I go, you know what? A lot of things could go right in that division. And I wouldn't be surprised if you end up with a good offense under Clint Kubiak and back into the playoffs with Derek Carr. Whether it can go farther than that, I would be skeptical on because I think there is a ceiling, but that's what it usually comes down to though. I mean, these guys, I've said this kind of before about Kirk, like, he's just good enough to get you fired. He's just good enough to raise the bar high enough to you think that everybody did something wrong and then you fire them and try someone else. And then we all do it again. So that's kind of where these guys live.
One thing that always goes right in afternoon reading, football is a numbers game. Make sure you go check that out. Matthew, thank you for your time, your insight. All that was great. We'll be back right after this break.
It's carnival time at New Orleans Hamburger and Seafood Company. Our gumbo combos are back. Enjoy our hot gumbo, fries, and your choice of shrimp, catfish, soft-shell crab, or frog legs starting at $9.99 at New Orleans Hamburger and Seafood Company.
Are you tired of renting and ready to own your dream home? Contact Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, your trusted source for home loans. Our competitive rates and flexible terms can help make your home ownership dreams a reality. If you're a first-time home buyer or looking to refinance, our experienced lenders are here to help. Our online application process allows you to apply on your schedule. It's quick, easy, and convenient. Visit us online at jeffersonfinancial.org to learn more. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
Martin Wine and Spirits is home to a selection of hand-picked barrel select bourbon, whiskeys, and much, much more. They are family owned and operated since 1946 and specialize in wine, spirits, gourmet food, gift baskets, catering, and tasting events. They have many locations, so they're never too far away. You can check them out in Metairie, New Orleans, Mandeville, and Baton Rouge, or if it's more convenient, you can always shop online. Whether you're a wine novice or a seasoned collector, you'll enjoy the Martin Wine and Spirit experience. All right, so this week I seen my first tweet saying that the Saints have to cut all their players to be able to field a team next year, so I figured it was a good time to have a talk about the salary cap, and who better to do that with than my guy Brad from PFF, I think, for my money, the best cap analyst in the whole entire business. Brad, what do you think the Saints are going to do next year when they don't have any players and they just have to have all league minimum players after they cut everybody?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the kind words. Yeah, it's funny because I think you and I talk, and this is like a Saints 6 out of 10. This is Kai Harley saying this is light work. Like, we'll restructure some guys. Yeah, they're going to have talent there. I wouldn't worry about it. They'll be all right.
Yeah, so right now, over the cap, I'm projected to be about $83 million over the cap. And as you said, I don't think it's a big deal for them. There's a lot of very obvious moves this year, too, for them to get under the cap. So I don't think, like you said, light work for them overall. But you study the whole league and how cap management works. Just kind of from your perspective, looking at everyone, I know everyone here kind of has their own view of how the Saints do things, and it's a little bit different than what a lot of other people think. What is your thought process, just kind of in general, your take on how the Saints do manage the cap?
Yeah, I think it's something that over time I've appreciated more and understood more. And the simple ideal that other teams also have, like Philadelphia, of, you know, believing in salary cap inflation. The idea that a dollar on the cap today is worth more than a dollar on the cap when the cap is $300 million in, let's say, you know, three years. So that's the general principle. It's very simple. And off of that, if you want to retain talent and find a way to do so, you can. And so, it's interesting when you transition from the Breeze years, maybe people thinking they would kind of pivot and tear it down after that. They obviously chose to continue with the same structure. But at the end of the day, if everything crashes and all the older veterans, DeMario and Cam, guys that are still playing at a very high level, if they filter out, yeah, you just maybe have 1 year where the credit card bill comes due, and it's going to be tough for any team to replace a bunch of Pro Bowl, All-Pro caliber veterans that have been there for a decade. Like, it's not like it's something that is easier if you have more cap space, in any given year.
You said something interesting there that your view of it kind of changed and evolved over time. Like, what was it about just that passage of time, like where you started at and where you kind of are now, and what were the things that you saw that kind of influenced how you kind of view how they do things?
Yeah, I think to a degree, if you don't have some proration and some dead money, to an extent, you're not really trying to, maybe in any given year, spend more cash than the salary cap in that season, and do different things to just be aggressive and to try to win games. And then more so just like when you talk about rebuild and we're trying to start things over, does it really matter all that much if you have 80 million in dead cap in a single season versus 50? You got to start over. You got to draft well, get young talent. It doesn't, maybe make things a little bit more difficult for 1 year. But in theory, it doesn't, at the end of the day, you got to draft good players, have good young talent, and it all kind of just starts from there.
It's funny. My first question ever to Mickey Loomis when I came down here in 14, I asked him what they were going to do about the cap. And it was just like this huge mess. And then it was kind of the same thing. Just over time, you're just like, wait, like they make this work. And the panic is just kind of all for nothing. But, again, I think down here we've kind of whistled by some things that we probably shouldn't have whistled by as far as the cap goes. Is there anything you see like teams that do kind of go this way that where it is maybe more limiting than it is for other teams that run, quote unquote, a clean cap?
I mean, to a certain degree, and again, we go back and forth, and it's always revisionist history. Like, did they want to keep a Trey Hendrickson? Did they want to keep a Marcus Williams? I think if they really, really wanted to, they probably would have found a way to get that done. So you still are making tough decisions and maybe saying we would love to keep him, but we think we have to save a little bit of cash here, go a veteran route, save money. But again, we've seen this team when they want to retain talent, they find a way to do it. So that's probably the one thing is just like maybe you make more tough decisions. And then again, I've said it 5 times already now, but like, if you do have a couple down draft years, which the Saints, I guess, kind of have compared to that run from, 16 to 20 range, it's just when you, if you have to supplement the roster more in free agency, it's obviously more of a challenge because you're trying to, clear a bunch of cap space, get ready for March. You can't use post-June cuts because obviously it doesn't come until later. And maybe you miss out on a free agent signing or two because of your lack of flexibility.
One thing they've said here that they kind of believe here is that player salaries are inflating faster than the cap, and that kind of lends credence to kind of doing things the way they do. And they've said that other teams have started doing it a little bit more as a reaction to that. Is that something that you've kind of noticed too, like just as far as the league trends?
Yeah, so I used to look at, when I do a lot of market analysis, at the top of the market, you would see over a stretch of, let's say, 5 years, a position market's growth and the cap growth, which for a while was about 7%. If you average it over a decade, there'd be, a year where the position didn't go up at all, but over a 5 year stretch would be kind of in line, maybe a little bit ahead. Now you're seeing the markets at the top just explode, and quarterback in particular, where I think they even said about Derek Carr, like, look, we think we can get a quality starter, but not have to go spend $60 million, $55 million, and spend half of that, and find a way to supplement the roster elsewhere and still be a competitive football team. So, yeah, it is exceeding now. The player position growth is exceeding the cap growth at a more elevated rate than you would have seen from the early 2010s.
And the big topic down here right now, just as far as cap management, the option bonus that Marshawn Lattimore agreed to and signed in December, which, to my understanding, makes it a little bit easier to trade him if they want to do that. Can you just kind of, explain how option bonuses work and how often do you actually see those show up in people's contracts?
So they're in there a good bit. You're going to see them more now. I mentioned Philly a bit ago. The Philly's workaround of wanting to add void years to prorate every contract on their roster is, instead of going to the player, because if you want to add void years, you have to get sign a new deal. There's basically option bonuses in every single year of their contracts, and what a bonus does is just picks up a later year because that is how the option works, is you're exercising the right to another year of the contract. So you'll see them more common. They're not super common per se. It depends on the team. The Lattimore move is really mirroring the Aaron Rodgers move, where at the outset the plan was put an option bonus on a contract, and what that is It's all salary as of right now. But if you exercise the option, it turns into a prorated money, signing bonus, spread it out over 5 years. And that's how it then gets treated on the cap and from a cash perspective in most cases. So what the Packers did was, all right, same thing. Week before the first week of the season, we will have an option bonus to either pick up or decline. And it bought them time to make a trade. They eventually went a different route. They, you know, kind of restructured the entire contract. But the high-level key here is, if you trade that player right now and over the cap, you'd see the full option bonus is prorated on Lattimore's page. That wouldn't it wouldn't stay on their books. It would travel to the new team because you have not paid the actual cash yet. So it's a prorated bonus that you can move, which we probably talked about is like not a thing you can do, but because it's not actually paid out yet.
So that's Philly was the pioneers, kind of like they did the deal that the Saints kind of mimicked on Mike Thomas last year. Now that, like, how innovative is Philly, kind of like the most influential team in terms of like stuff going out to the rest of the league?
Yes. Philadelphia is doing things contractually that some teams probably don't even know what exactly they're doing. I don't know. Shout out the names of the guys over there, but they are the best football administration department in the NFL. I mean, Howie Roseman it came through the football admin ranks. So, you know, he makes sure they're just, you know, and look, Kai Harley is certainly in that conversation as well, that they are doing things that I'm learning from each offseason. But yeah, I think Philly, people would probably agree, is kind of the gold standard in terms of, you know, manipulating the CBA, finding loopholes, and just leveraging every angle of a contract to benefit themselves.
Now, I don't know how much you've actually studied the Saints or kind of know what's on their books right now, but there are four contracts that I think the fans kind of view as kind of the albatrosses. And before I let you get out of here, I want to know what you would do with each one of these. Cam Jordan, he has a $23 million cap number, $13 million in restructurable money. If you were kind of writing your article about like good moves, bad moves, would touching that be something that you would do? Like, what would you do about Cam's deal? He kind of had no production this year. How does that one kind of look to you as you hear those numbers?
So not a great year, but the money is already all fully guaranteed. By that, I mean the salary and you know, non-prorated bonuses. So because it's already fully guaranteed, it's either it's hitting the cap this year, or like I said, you're just buying into inflation and pushing it out. If it was non-guaranteed money, maybe you say, hey, could you maybe take a pay cut? But that's probably not going to happen. So yeah, I'm restructuring the Cam Jordan deal. I know we had a down year, but it's a moot point, really.
And you got Taysom Hill. He's got $10 million you can kind of play around with. Do you feel like he's kind of worth the money based on the limited production that he has? New offensive coordinator coming in, maybe not the same type of usage.
It's a good point. I feel like Kubiak would probably be, you know, open to using him in some creative ways. You see the usage of H-backs and Juszczyk where he came from when he was in Minnesota. You can see CJ Ham and Tyler Conklin would do a lot of different roles. So I think there is a role, maybe substantially so, for Taysom in this offense. That's one where, again, it's $10 million salary, not guaranteed. Where I'm saying, look, you've been here. We love you. We obviously build packages around you in the low red zone, stuff like that. Chop that number in half. And let's ride and hope he says yes.
Yeah, I'm pay cut guy on him too. I want him around, but I don't think I can pay him that much for what he does. Ramchek has the knee injury. He has $17 million that can kind of be played around with. Do you touch it or do you kind of try to expire pay cut? Where are you going with that one?
Yeah, that one's interesting. Some of the verbiage I saw from him, you know, not that he's going to retire tomorrow, but you know, talking like a guy that you don't love to hear from, like a 29, maybe soon to be 30-year-old player. $17 million salary, certainly not small. I mean, when healthy, he still is one of the best tackles in football. I would even know more as a doctor, or I'd be consulting a medical team on that one, for sure.
And the last one, and I feel like this one's kind of moot too, because when they signed him, they were always going to restructure their car. You know, he has the big number in year two, no number really in year one. It's just kind of how they do their contracts. But if they didn't touch it, there's kind of the out after this year. You kind of lock in a little bit more if you do restructure. What would you do with him?
I think they'll restructure there. Like you said, this was kind of a foregone conclusion when it first happened. You know, I saw the report the other day that they were going to restructure him. It wasn't the most shocking report I've ever seen. So I think you do it. Again, it's kind of the same principle. Just, yeah, you would maybe like to have it out, but at the end of the day, it's all fully guaranteed. It's going to hit the cap at some point. Why not push it down the road?
Yeah, that segment right there is why you should read everything Brad writes. He knows who has guaranteed money just coming on off the cuff on a podcast. Brad, appreciate your time. Thanks for talking cap with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great stuff there from Brad. Always a great resource when talking about the salary cap. One of the best there is analyzing it. Definitely gets it more than a lot of other people get it. So make sure you check out his work on Pro Football Focus. All right. It's time for Martin's question of the day. Martin's is home to a wide selection of hand-picked, barrel-select, bourbon, whiskeys, and more. Martin's, so much more than just wine. And this is a really great question from Ardo. While there are many unknowns about how the offense might turn out next season, how confident are you that the defense doesn't regress substantially and can't be the foundation of the team like they have been in DA's time as a head coach? I think this is the biggest question of the season, and I think they have to find ways to offset what looks like inevitable regression coming forward. Like, DeMario Davis hasn't shown signs of aging, but he might at some point. So that's something that you always have to protect against. Cam Jordan's getting older. There's a possibility that Marshon Lattimore gets traded. The safeties are getting a little bit older. They don't have the pass rush that they need. How long can you get away with kind of operating like that? So I think that you have to look at it from a practical point of view, and that you got to do things to make sure that you're adding to this group and making sure that you're building where you need to be built upon. So they need to go out. They need to get more pass rush. If they let Lattimore go, you need to have a plan, because letting a guy like that go, you don't just replace him. And it's usually not replaceable with just one guy. So how do your safeties get better? How does your coverage get better? How do you protect against all of that? Is it Alante Taylor moving to the outside? Well, if it is, how do you make sure that you don't see some of the big plays that he allowed the last time he was on the outside? How do you make sure that he's kind of playing within himself? I mean, I think the natural growth of his just career arc is going to keep him in that position, but you got to find ways to protect against it. And I think you can get a little bit better in the slot by moving Alante to the outside. There's probably ways to do that, and it's probably a little bit cheaper to address it that way. But when you take a guy like Lattimore out of your defense, it's going to be a substantial hit one way or another. So they need to find a way, if that happens, to make sure they're protecting against it. But even if he stays on the team, I think that you still have to look at all those other areas and make sure that you're doing different things by bringing in different players. And I think one of the big things here is that it isn't just a player issue. I think that the scheme needs to make sure that they're being attacking and going after it. And we saw them shift to that more in the second half of the season, and they got better on defense. They became more consistent. Whereas earlier in the year, they were kind of being a little bit more passive, waiting for mistakes and changing up some of the things that they were doing. And the DA scheme really wasn't quite the classic DA scheme. And they found their way back to that later in the season, and I thought it worked pretty well. So I think if you're going to it with an attacking point of view, you go into it with the plan of how to get the right players and how to get better at different spots, particularly on the defensive line, which I think is going to need a significant free agent investment, not just in the draft, free agent investment. I think if you do those things, you can still be strong on defense, but I don't think that just having this great scheme is going to be enough right now. You got to marry the scheme with the right players to make sure you're getting everything you can out of your defense. And speaking of scheme and schemes to players, Mike will be back next week. We're going to have another show on Friday. I'm going to be running that one solo again. So we'll have that. And then we're going to be back to our normal scheduled type of program on Monday. We appreciate all your guys' support. Make sure you sign up to the website. And until next time.